Thanks, Mohammed. Hearing, listening to that, yeah, my wife says I have too many affiliations, so I can't take any more unless I cut one out. That's what she said. So I put my two most important ones here. University of Waterloo, I'm a full-time professor on campus, and I'm an associate faculty here where my main duties are running this group of misfits we call the Perimeter Institute Quantum Intelligence Lab, or PICL. So there's lots of things I could talk about. We've been running this, I guess Mohammed and who else, you know, Lauren and you know, Juan's been teaching this you know, machine learning for many body lectures for a number of years now. And I kind of had a lecture where I pointed out lots of PSI student and perimeter masters and PhD contributions, but it got to be too many and I couldn't fit it all in 1 hour. So I changed the theme a little bit this year. I thought we'd talk about a couple topics specifically related to some of the research we're doing at PICL and other places in the region that center around generative models. So I looked at a couple of the lectures that you guys have received recently, and I think you pretty much have all the background that I need to talk about how we're using generative models. And then I want to talk about applications to what I'm calling quantum simulation, which in another way of thinking is really you know, building a quantum computer or, you know, controlling a quantum device for you know, I guess physical applications. So that's my outline. Feel free to interrupt me throughout and I can jump around. So if you find this completely boring, just tell me and I'll think about other things to talk about. But I got tons of slides. By the way, what do we do this for an hour, roughly? Okay. So I'll try to keep on time. We are in the age of generative AI. No, I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm so old now that I like remember what, you know, back in the days before generative AI was a big thing and so on. So it's fun to watch the progress of artificial intelligence, you know, as a practitioner, you know, working on it in physics. For our purposes, I thought I would just distinguish between, you know, discriminative tasks, which I think you've heard about, you know, a feed-forward neural network that tells the difference between a picture of a cat and a picture of a dog, right? And a generative task, which formally you can write, you know, in terms of, you know, conditional probabilities and joint distributions and so on. But you can get the idea about what a generative task is, you know, just by, you know, looking at the lectures that you guys have had. Really, what you're trying to do is generate instances from a probability distribution that you've learned, and I'll talk more about the setting. There's lots of generative models out there. I think you've learned about quite a few generative models. Ones that might get you and Simon excited are diffusion models and also flow-based models, which I know that you guys have talked about. And I do want to get the idea of kind of a prompt out of the way. So I was looking at, you know, prompts for Midjourney. What is Midjourney? Is it a diffusion?
Midjourney is diffusion.
Stable diffusion, right? So I'm not going to talk about it, but I just think it's funny. And I think if, you know, you ever see a generated picture on the internet based on this prompt, a stormtrooper family in the style of Norman Rockwell, for example, I think most of these come from diffusion models, right, at this day and age. Semimol and I had this debate a while ago, but, you know, generative models, and so, as you know, I'm putting them in this, you know, diffusion-based models, flow-based models. You know, my question for him was, are these related to energy-based models? I think we've decided that they're not, but I mentioning energy-based models because you've learned about them in class here. And in physics, these were a set of generative models that we first started looking at, you know, in the context of many-body simulation and condensed matter and so on. And so I'll get back to some examples of how we've used energy-based models. But the classic definition, I think, is, you know, you're generating instances from a probability distribution P of X that's defined like this. There's a partition function, e to the minus energy. Okay, and I'll get back to the importance of that partition function, you know, more than once. Language models, I think, is a very broad definition. Actually, I don't know how you define a language model other than it's used for language, natural language processing tasks. One distinguishing feature of language, as you've learned, is that it typically occurs in a sequence, right? So here I've used Talk the Transformer. It's just this website. I think it uses GPT-3. And the first, you know, Hickory Dickory Dock, the mouse, that's basically what I prompted it with. That's the start of the sequence. And everything in the green is what it's generated. And I like the old Transformers because they give you lots of nonsense, right? This is before it like was really, I think they're really performing really well. So this is GPT-3. And the generative part of this language task is to complete the text. And, you know, so ran up the clock. So it all, you know, it almost starts getting the poem correctly. And then, you know, basically it starts going crazy. So that's just an example of, you know, generative models in artificial intelligence. So I'm mostly going to talk about language models. And as you learn from Mohammed, the beauty of having a sequence is that, you know, you can decompose the generative model, you know, the task of generative modeling into conditional probabilities of elements along the sequence, right? So Hickory Dickory Dock, the mouse, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 words, you know, what the generative model will output for you, the language model, will be the conditional distribution of the 6th word conditioned on those previous 5, right? If I got that right. So then when it's sampled, ran, you know, you can ask for the conditional distribution of the 7th word based on the previous 6 and so on. And when you multiply all those conditionals together, you get the full normalized joint distribution. I'll come back to that. And oh, by the way, yeah, the joint, the normalization, you know, in this sense, in energy-based models requires the partition function, and in this case doesn't. So that's a big difference between energy-based models and some of these other models and the autoregressive networks. And, you know, because I stole these slides from one of my colloquia, I think it's just fun to see the performance of some of these language models, particularly GPT-3 to GPT-4 was a huge jump in performance, you know, which occurred about a year ago. That's the difference between the green and the blue. And I like to show this one because, I mean, this is the US-based testing, but AP Physics 2, GPT-3 was scoring like, you know, 30% on it, and it jumped up to 70, probably better than I could do. I mean, certainly better than I can do. And it's fun, you know, GPT-4's score would put it in a good position to be admitted into the top 20 law schools, you know, basically in the US, and including Harvard, Stanford, Princeton, and Yale. I was at Harvard and Yale giving this talk, and I showed this, and then, like, you know, no chuckles at all. Like, nobody appreciates the fact that, you know, that an AI can pass their entrance exam for law school. So that big difference between GPT-3 and GPT-4, does anyone know what caused that big jump in performance?
The number of training parameters?
The number of, so there's 3 ingredients in the models, yeah. So number of parameters, amount of data, and the amount of compute. Yeah, so yeah, training, I think there was a big jump in number of parameters, right? I can't remember the numbers, I wrote them down somewhere, but did it get to a billion parameters? Is that what it is? Or is it a trillion? I forget. Again, I got it later in some slides.
The magnitude is correct, I think.
I think it's all 3 of those. Compute, data, and number of parameters in the model. The amount of data, and I have this later in the slides. Basically, these things are now being trained off the entire internet in some sense, right? So you can get an idea for scale.
That's a good question. So here, it seems to do much worse in calculations, right? In some mathematical tasks. Environmental science, even GPT-3 does it very well, history and so on. So anything
right.
Does it well. Does that relate to what you said before, where like words, sentences are in a sequence and calculations have a bit more complicated form? Or why is it bad in calculation?
I don't know if anyone can answer that, but yeah, I would guess that regurgitating sentences that make sense is a lot easier than like solving a physics problem. You know, I don't really know how you quantify that, but I would guess so. If you look at the GPT-4 technical paper, it's really interesting because you can give it visual prompts. So you can take a screenshot of your physics paper, send it in as a visual prompt, and ask it to solve that, and that almost has nothing to do with language, right?
Yeah.
I think some of the other criticisms are that I mean, it's a probabilistic model for language. So it's very much a generative model, like in this sense here, right? You're generating somehow, you know, the next element of a sentence or something like that. And I think there's arguments to be made that not everything is probabilistic. Not everything is, you know, can be solved with these probabilistic models, including language. I think Noam Chomsky, you know, famously derides probabilistic approaches to language. You know, very much he has some sort of formal grammar, and he wants to, you know, do structure, you know, structure language based on that, and so on. So I think that has a lot to do with it. They're really powerful. They're probably not the be-all, end-all for AI. But they, okay, so I want to talk a little bit about the what we call emergence in these models, which I think relates in a nice high-level way to what we study in condensed matter physics and in quantum information physics. But before I get to that, maybe just a few things that you already know. So I'm going to go through them fairly quickly. So the setting that I'm mostly talking about is what we call density estimation for generative models. And what we're imagining is that we have a black box, and inside that black box, we can draw samples from it. And so my X are the vectors that are representing, you know, every sample of something. Maybe it's a picture of a giraffe, right? And that box is all possible pictures of a giraffe on the internet. X1 is one instance, X2 is another picture, X3 blah, blah, is another picture. And I take all those, you know, and what are, you know, what are the vectors made of? The zeros and ones are pixels. So maybe these are black and white pictures. I'm stretching this pretty far. What I'm going to tell you is that black box is a quantum computer, and the X's are the qubit projective measurement outcomes. But, you know, you can map back and forth between all of these problems. So we assume that all we have access to is those vectors, X1, X2, X3, and however many samples you've pulled from that black box, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, or something like that. That's your training set in some sense. We don't have access to P of X inside of that black box. So what the task for generative models is, the basic core task, is to estimate the density or the probability based on just those samples, X. So how do you do it? You define a model, and the model has typically some parameters. Okay, and I'm calling those parameters lambda, or sometimes you call them theta, right? And I just have a schematic of a neural network there. That could be a Hopfield network, right? And the parameters could be all those lines, the edges, which are the learnable weights of the Hopfield network, for example. Your goal is to, you know, adjust those weights and biases so that the model is as close as possible in likelihood to what's in the black box, right? You're trying to estimate P of X by adjusting those parameters based only on that data. And as you know, you can frame that learning problem with this cost function. So this is the log likelihood. And the nice thing is that you can essentially, you know, calculate the estimator of log of P of lambda. You're given those instances X drawn from that black box without explicitly knowing P of X. So you don't need to know what's in the black box in order to calculate the estimator of the loss function, right? So that's derived from the Kullback-Leibler divergence, for example. And those angle brackets, you know, I have angle log P lambda X with a P on the outside. That just means that those X are drawn from that black box distribution, right? And then training is something like gradient descent, right? Which, I don't know, somehow these things are always trained on gradient descent. And did you guys cover variational optimization too? Or no, yeah? So then there's another setting, of course, which is a variational setting, and where the loss function isn't related to data, but it's related to some knowledge of the underlying interactions in your physical system. So, okay, this is very general, density estimation. If I have a physical system described by a Hamiltonian, then, which as physicists, we have kind of this advantage, as we have access to this sometimes. We can also take any generative model, essentially, and optimize it from knowledge of the Hamiltonian or knowledge of the Lagrangian or the interactions instead of from the data. So I mentioned it here. I put it in a red box because it's a little outside of density estimation via data. But I would call these two different strategies. The first one is a data-driven strategy. And the second one is a physics-informed strategy or a Hamiltonian-driven strategy or something like that. So, but one point here is that these architectures that you're learning about, RBMs, RNNs, transformers, GANs, they can always be optimized from data, or they can, in physics applications, if you have a knowledge of the underlying interactions, then you can do some variational way of optimizing these things. So they're very powerful architectures. And I, you know, I think we have access to this other training scenario, which is an advantage for us in physics. Okay, so I like to think of myself as a computational physicist, although I couldn't get my my SSH key for Git to work this week, so I think I'm giving up on that. But I think there's two broad perspectives that you touched on in class, you know, from the computational physics side of things. That help inform us about how these generative models work in some sense. And again, one important distinction I think is worth pointing out between energy-based models and autoregressive models. So energy-based models, and I've written an RBM, which I think you've covered in class, where you have a visible space on the left, a hidden space on the right. You know, you have a variable expressive capacity by changing the amount of hidden units on the right there, the binary units. There's your, you know, those equations in the middle, P of lambda. You know, that's the likelihood, that's the joint distribution over visibles and hiddens. When you marginalize on the second line, the hidden units, is my mouse working here? When you marginalize the hiddens, you get P of lambda, that's the model's likelihood over the visibles, right? E is this energy function, and those are the parameters. So I think you've probably all seen this in some form before. The existence of that constant, the partition function, which you know in any many-body system is essentially exponentially difficult to calculate. It's intractable by that definition. Makes it so that if you want to draw samples from this model, so if you want to generate samples from the generative model, you typically have to do it with some sort of Markov chain Monte Carlo sampling. Markov chain is great. I love Monte Carlo. But in these scenarios, samples that are produced are always correlated. So if you think of a 2D Ising model and you flip a single spin and you're asking whether to accept or reject that move, out of n spins, you've only changed one spin. And so the sample before and the sample after are highly correlated, right? And so that correlation between samples is captured by what we call an autocorrelation function. If I turn my head sideways, I don't know what it is. It's basically a connected two-point function. I could do a better job here. Which starts at one. A sample is 100% autocorrelated with itself, you know, and then decays as you go along this Markov chain time. And so here's a typical decay of an autocorrelation function. You know, so I could say after 200 time steps, my samples basically become uncorrelated, right? But it takes 200 samples to get there. In contrast, if you have an autoregressive model, like I'm going to show, like you learned about, like an RNN, that RNN encodes a joint distribution through the product of all these conditionals, each one of which is normalized, and therefore the joint distribution is normalized. It's just my P lambda X, you know. And because it's normalized, there is no partition function calculation required. You don't need any sort of Markov chain sampling. And so every single sample that you produce is IID in principle. It's an exact sample. And so generated samples are uncorrelated. That's, I think, one powerful advantage of autoregressive models. Any questions about this? Does this make sense? I think from a physics perspective, it's a nice, you know, a nice way of seeing how the intractability of the partition function affects you in some sense. So let's think about language models, just because I don't know why. This is what my slides are for. So autoregressive models, of course, again, hickory dickory dock. Just like I said, that's the sequence. If I want the next word in the sentence, the output is PX5 conditioned on the four previous words, right? And one point is that you can easily turn this into a representation of a quantum state via several mechanisms. One, if your wave function is real and positive, which I'll talk about later, essentially is a probability distribution or The probability distribution is a square of the wave function. I guess that's what these arrows mean. So I could imagine mapping a sequence of words to a sequence of qubit measurement outcomes, for example. Okay, here's qubit one, and I could select, say, I don't know, state one out of that. So it's like I've collapsed the wave function in some sense. And the generative, I could ask the generative model to produce the next outcome in the sequence. So what would be the state of qubit two conditioned on qubit one, right? And if I get that conditional probability, and then I sample maybe the zero from qubit two, then I can ask, what is the conditional probability of the outcome of a measurement on three conditioned on two, and so on. So in that sense, I can map a sequence of language, where I have a dictionary, in this case of seven words, to a sequence of qubit measurement, outcomes where my dictionary is of size two. Or if I had a larger local Hilbert space, the dimension of that Hilbert space is the size of my dictionary. So it's a very simple mapping from, sequences, I would guess, and language to something more relevant for us maybe, which is measurement outcomes from, say, a quantum state. Is this confusing? I'll show you more examples. Have you guys looked at this structure specifically? Okay. So here's Mohammed's RNN that we basically use all the time now for, now I see one problem with this slide is I've replaced X with sigma here. So every time you see sigma, just think of X. Otherwise, this is basically the sequence that I've told you about. A recurrent neural network autoregressive model encodes all the correlations through some latent parameters. And let me go back to the RBM. Just like you have a hidden space here, and you have all these weights that are connecting visibles and hiddens, and you can change the size of this layer so that if you have to, encode a wave function with more entanglement, you can give yourself more hidden, hidden units to work with. RNNs also have, a variable latent space, I guess is one way of thinking about it, that is encoded in these hidden vectors, which I've called H0, H1, H2, and so on, okay? So that those are, hidden, they're called hidden states or hidden vectors that are passed between, occurrences of the recurrent cell here. So, there's an initialization that happens with maybe a random hidden vector and a sort of null, input. And then this RNN cell, this green thing here, is essentially a bunch of kind of nonlinear functions. Very simply, the output, say, given a vector hn minus 1, so h1 given h0, is some nonlinear and some transformation that includes weights and biases. So the learnable parameters are contained within, application of this nonlinear function, which outputs, the next, state of the hidden state in the sequence. That hidden state h of n can also be manipulated with another set of weights and biases, which are, the learnable or trainable parameters in your RNN, and then pass through a softmax function, which gives you a normalized conditional distribution as the output. Right, so that's what I said was important. So here's your, what's this called, Bernoulli version of the normalized output. So that normalized output, again, can be multiplied together to give you a normalized joint distribution. In this case, what we're interested in is the joint distribution, say, for example, of all qubit measurement outcomes in a quantum computer. And then for every instance, so here I've sampled sigma one, that can be passed in. See, there's the sample into the next, recurrent cell. Outcomes H2 goes to the softmax. Y is the normalized conditional. It's sampled to get sigma two, and then I can get sigma three conditioned on sigma two and H2 and so on. Right. So that's basically how the RNN works. You can unroll the sequence is basically as long as you want. You can combine all of the measurement outcomes to give you one sample. That's like one generated sample of your qubit measurement outcomes. And again, the product of all the y's would be your square, what is it? Size. So P squared, so P would be, you know, the square of the product would be your wave function in this case, if there's no phase. And Mohammed and Juan for several years worked on different basically ways of including phase information, but I'm kind of going to gloss over that. So if you do have a sine structure in your wave, your quantum wave function, or if you have a phase structure, they're you know, one way is passing it through a soft sine, but there are ways of including the phase. Okay, so if there was no complex phase, again, the wave function is just square root of p. But if you need a complex phase, there's ways of dealing with that. And you know, Juan, you know, just kind of a historical note, back in 2018. First used RNN, so we were always using RBMs, restricted Boltzmann machines, to represent these many-body quantum states. And Juan noticed basically performance increases in using RNNs. And you can look back to his first use, I think this is it, right, Mohammed? Back in 2018, when he was taking POVM measurements instead of simple projective measurements and learning the density matrix underlying them. So basically, it was just an empirical observation that these RNNs work very well for this task. And so essentially, we've been using them ever since 2018. And so there's all sorts of sophisticated ways that you can encode wave functions and density matrices and learn them from data and so on. Questions on the RNN? So one observation about RNNs, which is probably in your mind, is, you know, how does it make sense to map a sequence of words in language to a sequence of qubit outcomes when the qubits aren't necessarily in a one-dimensional array, right? They could be in any dimensional array. They could have essentially any interactions. They could have any sort of non-local entanglement in there. So the idea of having this 1D sequence seems like an artifact of the autoregressive, you know, causality essentially. And so to kind of just see that, you know, every time you have one of these nonlinears in the previous, the RNN recurrent cell from the previous slide, and you're passing a hidden vector and an instance of, whatever the variable is that you sampled, right? It goes through this parameterized nonlinear function f of lambda, which makes a lot of sense for language. But if I had a two-dimensional atom array, say, and that was my quantum computer, again, you know, why would I prefer, a one-dimensional sequence? So, for example, here's a one-dimensional sequence in red going through this two-dimensional qubit array. But obviously, you know, here's site 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Site 1 and 6 are actually nearest neighbors, but have a distance, 5 in that sequence, right? So what you don't want to do is pass, I'm guessing, you probably don't want to pass, a hidden vector through 5 different nonlinears in order to encode those correlations, because you really don't know how those correlations degrade, as you push them through that nonlinear. So in RNNs, you can do things like explicitly pass, hidden units between nearest neighbors in this array. And you can actually generalize this very generally in this type of diagram. So here's an RNN that I've mapped out along the sequence that's taking hidden vectors, for every single, unit back, or every single qubit back along the sequence from it. So I think this is the most general way. Is there a name for this RNN?
Dilated?
Yeah, so this is the dilated RNN. So again, you can't have any correlations passed ahead of it, but you can have all correlations passed behind it. And that's because that autoregressive sequence has some notion of causality, okay? So this is, what's the downsides of a dilated RNN?
Computational complexity.
Yeah.
It just has like an overhead, like in terms of like the connections. The more connections you add, the more computational complexity.
Okay, I can see that, right? Because every time you pass a hidden, now it has n minus whatever down that sequence hidden vectors that you have to pass is nonlinear. So I can see it getting computationally hard.
So this can realize like even O2O interactions in your two-dimensional array?
It could, yeah. Yeah, we use them for Rydberg atoms, which are all-to-all connected, yeah. But I think it's a balance between expressiveness, expressiveness or representational capacity, which means how well are we encoding entanglement, versus computational complexity, which is, you know, everything we're talking about. How hard is it to process all these, you know, hidden vectors through these nonlinears and things like that? And that's the basic give and take of the quantum many body problem, I think. How do you get an expressive onsots that can be efficiently optimized, you know, computationally? So, you know, since 2017, of course, probably since 2019 in practice, RNNs have been replaced largely by transformers and language applications, you know, in actual industry applications like GPT and so on. And I won't go through the transformer. You know, I've been staring at this diagram for years. I still don't understand what it means. But I think one point which Juan and other authors pointed out in this paper is that unlike the most general RNN that I showed, where you essentially can't encode, you know, hidden units back, you know, that violate the causality of the autoregressive sequence back in time, forward in time. One observation about the transformer is you can encode all pairwise correlations through the attention mechanism. So in this masked multi-headed attention mechanism, you essentially still have an autoregressive model. So you still have an autoregressive sequence in the transformer. But all the correlations are encoded pairwise between all, say, qubits. And what you do is you just mask out the ones that occur ahead of time in the causal whatever list. And so like Juan says, you know, there's still a lot of debate about this. I was just in Urbana-Champaign talking to Brian Clark, who's on this paper. He says this is still valid, but you know, essentially the analogy that physicists can make between the attention mechanism is the Jastrow factor, which you can Google, which is a sort of standard variational onsots that Juan and others worked on for years, which includes all pairwise correlations, you know, before the masking. But I think I'm just putting this as an observation. There is lots of, I think, room for physicists to contribute to ideas that lie behind transformers and their efficiency and whether or not they're better than RNNs, whether or not they're worse, whether or not we can inform, you know, the design of these things and so on. So I'm just going to leave it at that. Transformers are out there. We're currently working on them. They seem to be very promising. And there's a lot of analogies we can make and a lot of understanding between, you know, how the correlations are encoded in transformers and how we need to encode correlations in physical systems. But why are we excited about transformers? One of the reasons is that they exhibit what I'm going to call scaling and emergence. Okay, scaling is our goal in condensed matter and in quantum information in many applications. Scaling, I want to scale a quantum computer up to, I don't know what, enough qubits to break 2048-bit RSA encryption. Maybe that's 4 million qubits, maybe it's more. You know, there's all sorts of scaling challenges in quantum computing. For those of us that work on the control stack, you can see there's lots of control infrastructure that's difficult to scale. There's all sorts of things that are hard to scale. Condensed matter is the same thing. I want to study the, you know, superconductivity in the Hubbard model, but how do I do that without a computational strategy that scales? Emergence, in some sense, is the goal of scaling. What we want to see in a quantum computer is non-trivial calculations that we can't do classically, perhaps, you know, emerge out of the hardware that we're building. Or if I take the condensed matter analogy, what I want to see in my simulations of the Hubbard model is high temperature superconductivity emerge when I put enough, you know, interacting electrons together or something like that. So LLMs in the machine learning literature, and I'll point out this author, Steinhardt, have basically adopted this idea of scaling and emergence to explain the behavior of models. So here's one example of a transformer that scales very well in terms of its test loss when you increase the number of parameters, which is kind of counterintuitive. So if I have more parameters in my transformer, it tends to learn quicker and better than if I have less parameters. And that sets up basically the idea that I can scale these things to massive amounts of parameters and still have them perform very well. There's other ingredients, the amount of data and the amount of compute. So the number of epochs you train these things on are the other ingredients of LLMs. And here's some examples of emergence that have been observed in different tasks. So I don't know, modular arithmetic, I can't remember, some translation task where you can define an accuracy here. Model scale is the amount of data that's been pushed into the model measured in floating point numbers. So floating point operation, z. And you can see very tantalizingly as you get to 10 to the 23 flop, push through this LLM, you see a big jump in the accuracy. And what LLM people say is they call that emergence, okay? So there's two concepts of emergence kind of, but you know, it's very interesting that somehow when you get to a macroscopic scale, 10 to the 23, in terms of numbers that have been pushed into these models for training, you see a very abrupt change in behavior. And so machine learning people have borrowed the nomenclature from condensed matter. Emergence is when quantitative changes in a system result in qualitative changes in behavior. I don't know, that's not my favorite definition. I'd rather go with one from Anderson. So how does this relate to what we're doing? You know, we have an existence proof, for example, that high temperature superconductivity exists in the cuprates. I can levitate like one right here with, you know, liquid nitrogen if I had one. We know, for example, the crystal structure of, say, YBCO, and we have a very good understanding of the interacting Hamiltonian that underlies these materials that exhibit superconductivity. However, as physicists, if we study this Hamiltonian, we fail to see the emergence of superconductivity in it. Number one, because it's a highly interacting condensed matter system that we can't solve analytically. Number two, because our computer algorithms aren't powerful enough for some reason. They don't scale enough to observe this emergence. So we don't know how nature achieves a superconducting state, and we'd like to, but we can't recreate the existence of that state using our, you know, best guess for the microscopic interactions that underlie it. So again, what Phil Anderson and others defined is basically the concept of emergence. So it was meant to be, the counterpoint to what he calls, reductionalism, the ability to reduce everything down to simple fundamental laws. He said, that's fine, I can reduce things down to the Hubbard model, but that does not imply the ability to start from the Hubbard model and to reconstruct, okay, the universe number one, but I would say number two, even just superconductivity. That's kind of the origin of emergence. And I would argue that this problem is of fundamental importance for physicists because it's really the lowest level of emergence that we have. Okay, maybe you can think of lattice QCD or something, but you know, our theory of everything is encapsulated in that Hamiltonian. We believe that this is correct. We know that we have quantum electrodynamics, we have quantum field theory, we have a second quantized Hamiltonian that is very simple, it's electrons hopping. And you know, that's everything. I think that's every ingredient we need, and we don't have anything wrong there. So it's our base level of reductionalism for this problem. It's how the electrons interact, and they strongly interact in these systems. But going from that, you know, theory of everything, because that's really what it is. We have the theory of everything, and you know, explaining how superconductivity emerges in the cuprates, we can't do. So that's the lowest level, I would argue, of emergence that we're struggling with in physics. And then as you go up in complexity, you see many examples of this. It's very difficult to, you know, I don't know what, you know, reconstruct all of quantum chemistry. Obviously, right? We don't have good, you know, even numerical techniques to study many molecules and so on. And then you go up higher and higher and you get things like biology emerging, and then you get the human mind emerging and all this stuff. What's the highest level of emergence? So think of, you have a bunch of interacting brains that you're connecting on the internet. What emerges? Memes. Memes are the highest level of emergence, right? So keep that in mind. So we're just working at one level here. But so it's, you know, what does language models do? They help generate memes. So what are we doing? We're trying to adopt that technology, which has demonstrated emergence, down to the lowest level of emergence, which is what we deal with in physics, right? Okay, so here's some numbers that I was talking about. GPT-4 is 1 trillion parameters. It's incredible. It's trained on Avogadro's number of floating point operations. I showed you that. Costs $100 million to train, which is the amount of GPU time spent on it, essentially. So again, there's another question here about our carbon budget, whether or not we can afford, both with money and, you know, with the carbon output of the GPUs, whether we can afford to train language models for physical applications. But anyway, and today the entire internet is used for training data. So what I'm arguing in this talk is, you know, we can build models like this. We can build large scale models to study our most fundamental problems of emergence and so on. But, you know, this is the kind of resources that have to go into them. So can we do anything with quantum physics? Scaling is a central challenge. And I'm going to argue how this relates to quantum computing next. And a goal of quantum computers is to demonstrate emergence, you know, and how do we do it? So before I go on to my second part, which I'm going to go through quick, any questions on my meme lecture here, basis thesis of my lecture about memes?
Recurrence to me gives the feel of some sort of feedback, but you don't have any feedback in a quantum computer. So how does your use of the word recurrence here apply to what you're doing with it?
Use of the word what, sorry?
Recurrence.
Oh,
I think recurrence is meaning feedback, some sort of feedback loop.
Yeah, it's. I think it's fine. Recurrence usually means that, you know, I can have one recurrent cell here, and I can feed back the hidden unit or the hidden vector back into itself. I guess I don't have a great picture of that. So it could be recurrent in that sense. It just means, I think that's the main sense, right?
Yeah.
So I can still map, you know, the qubit problem to that recurrence. If I imagine, you know, feeding back this, if I imagine each one of these qubits is being represented by, say, one recurrent cell, and I feed back the hidden unit into itself. Yeah, so it doesn't have to do with recurrence in time data or anything like that. It has to do with the autoregressive sequence. Other questions? Why are we building a quantum computer? To study emergence. Okay, well, maybe we'll solve the computational problem and, I don't know what, variational approaches using neural networks will solve the Hubbard model. Maybe. That's up to Mohammed. It's not up to me. I have no idea. Another way to solve the Hubbard model is to construct it in a physical system, an experiment I'm talking about. And that experiment, you try to recreate the interactions that you believe underlie the phenomenon you're interested in. So if I think this is what underlies superconductivity and YBCO, I can map that to atoms or ions that are trapped in, I don't know what, optical potentials that can be tuned with lasers and other things so that they have different tunneling and interactions. So I can basically imagine tuning that Hamiltonian. And I guess the premise of a quantum simulator, which by which I mean a quantum computer, is that if I tune those interactions correctly and I can simultaneously scale to a large number of qubits, then maybe I can see the emergence of some phenomenon that I'm looking for and therefore say, okay, now I understand the ingredients and I've kind of solved this issue how do things emerge. So that's kind of what a quantum simulator is. We're not at the point yet where I can solve the Hubbard model, but we can solve some kind of basic interacting spin models. And so I'm going to show you some architectures that, you know, are now currently producing data that we can currently train, say, language models on that are, you know, making headway into this problem of quantum simulation. So Rydberg Atom Array is my favorite quantum computing platform. When was the Nobel Prize for optical tweezers? 2018. That's when Donna also won. Optical tweezers can, like, you know, basically create a potential minimum that you can trap a neutral atom in it, and it sticks in those optical tweezers. Now people can create arrays of thousands of optical tweezers, each one of which can capture an individual atom. So these individual atoms are the basis for qubit architectures, typically based on rubidium 87. And the two states of the system are, you know, the rubidium atom is captured and it's in its ground state, or it's excited with another laser beam so that it achieves a, like, principal quantum number of like 100-ish. That's called a Rydberg state. So ground state, Rydberg state, that's your qubit. They're strongly interacting, and I'll show you the Hamiltonian. And you can get good quality projective measurements of the qubit state, which is the Rydberg occupation, and very flexible geometries. So you can basically build really highly entangled quantum devices from these Rydberg atom arrays. This is the Hamiltonian, and which you don't have to really digest too much. It's really an Ising model, so I've written it in the occupation basis. So this is like 0 or 1, the Rydberg occupation. They're fully connected through this van der Waal type interaction, 1 over R6. Okay. There's a diagonal term that looks like a chemical, what are they called? Chemical potential, which is the laser detuning from resonance, and then basically a Rabi type term that, you know, generates a kinetic energy, if you will, between the ground state and Rydberg state. So the detuning is the splitting of the degeneracies, essentially, between ground and Rydberg. So the larger detunings, you want to get more excited atoms, but you have an energy penalty if they are too close to each other, and that's called the blockade. So here's an example of it. I've written this in terms of what we call a Rydberg blockade, or no, a blockade radius, sorry, RB. So you can imagine with this 1 over R6 potential, I can excite one atom, but it costs me too much energy to excite another one within that pink radius. And I can adjust all these things as every one of these atoms here is in an optical tweezer that I have the power to move in any geometry that I want. So one important point with the Hamiltonian, the reason I'm showing it, is it's what we call stochastic. Doesn't matter, it means the off-diagonal matrix elements can easily be made all non-positive. And a non-positive off-diagonal matrix element is a Hamiltonian. If you diagonalize it, the extremal eigenvectors, the extremal eigenvalues of eigenvectors that are all real and positive. So in these Rydberg atom systems, the ground states are all real positive. There's no phase. Therefore, I can reconstruct the probability distribution. I can reconstruct the wave function just from the probability distribution. Everything I told you about likelihood estimation can be used for these experiments. So I think that's really fun. I can just get data from the experiment, and I can train a standard generative model off them without worrying about the complex phase or anything like that. We've been doing this for years now, typically with the Harvard group, Misha Lukin's group, and their kind of spin-out company, Qera, just some Psi students here. Hansham Roger Luo, this is me and him in Qera, the company violating our NDAs by showing a picture of the table here. But this is the vacuum chamber that holds the Rydberg atoms. Here's Roger and Anna Knorr. She was a Psi student like last year, 2 years ago. And anyway, lots of fun on these experiments. I won't say too much about really what they do, but there's a probabilistic method of loading atoms, which results in some defects. They're in this vacuum chamber. There's a CCD image that's taken. Every one of these little dots is an atom, and it's been rearranged physically so that all of the occupied tweezers are near each other. They then undergo time evolution with the Hamiltonian to the desired, interaction state. And then here's a fluorescent readout, which the reds are the Rydberg states, which are actually not there. They're just circles that somebody drew. And these are the ground states. And here's a nice checkerboard state that's been prepared. And one point is when you do that readout in these experiments, you blow out the Rydberg atoms out of the tweezers. You have to reload them, rearrange them, let them time evolve every single shot. So they're very data limited. You can get 1,000 shots out of these machines if you run them for a few days. And Jonathan Kambla, who is a Psi Start student last year, we actually had him run the Qera device just to get some data and to figure out how long it took to get shots. And here's his distribution. It's hard to read. Basically, 3 shots a second is what he was getting out of this machine. But there's some distribution of that. So if you have a million qubits, and that's enough, 256 qubits is what these devices have, you can ask, how much data do I need in order to reconstruct the distribution? So going all the way back, to this picture. Every single shot is one of these vectors. And if I can get 1,000 of them, is that enough to reconstruct the probability distribution? I mean, you don't know a priori. Depends on how complicated that probability distribution is. So here's the basic tomographic question of these machines is, how much data is required to faithfully reproduce the ground state wave function inside the device? One good reason to use generative modeling. What generative models do is they give you an inductive bias, right? You bake some bias into that neural network, whatever it is, an RNN, an RBM, a transformer. That bias, in principle, can help with this problem. Here's the, you know, here's some data that I generated from a secret unknown distribution. You can guess what it is. It's a Gaussian. And I think if I had 200,000 or 500,000 measurements, I get a nice smooth curve like this. In principle, I can estimate the density without a model. I mean, that's the basic, you know, histogram method, right? Here's the same Gaussian that I sampled with like a couple thousand shots. And you can see the blue is the, you know, it's not all that clear that I'm getting full information here. And in fact, I have a lot of empty bins, right? And so if I ask the likelihood of, you know, I don't know, -5.5, I would get 0, which is wrong. So how do you combat that limited data? Well, you can use a model. And in this case, I'm not using a neural network, I'm using a Gaussian, because you know the exact function. So I'm fitting two parameters, the mean and the standard deviation. But if I fit those parameters to that data, I get the red curve, and it's basically perfect. So that's the power of inductive bias in your models, right? You're fitting parameters in the models instead of just doing a model-free, you know, whatever, likelihood estimation. And okay, I won't talk about it, but Giacomo Torla and Brian Timar did a lot of work in trying to figure out, you know, how much inductive bias improves sampling and so on. Back in 2019, we took data from these experiments and we reconstructed a restricted Bolson machine, wave function, on 3,000 projective measurements, and here's 8 atoms. And so here's basically the density as a function of detuning going across some phase transition. And you can see that the RBM reproduces the experiment exactly. And the red is the some sort of simulation, like a master equation simulation that we're trying to understand what goes on in the experiment. Why do we do this? Well, I haven't talked about it, but you can also calculate off-diagonal quantities now that you have the full wave function information, which are inaccessible to the experiment. So here is a RBM reconstruction of an off-diagonal expectation value compared to exact diagonalization of the master equation. And you can see all sorts of problems in the large detuning regime here. So this is exactly what I like to see with these types of studies, is we can go back to the experimentalists and say, hey, there's something going on with your large delta regime. And in fact, they fixed something with their parameterization on the device and they corrected this problem. And it never got published, so I'm showing it here. But it, again, it's, you know, the feedback between you know, experiments and, you know, I guess data-driven reconstruction, I think, is one thing I'd like to emphasize with this program. Sorry, Skylar, no time for your amazing work. There's all sorts of other things we can do with RBMs and RNNs. Here's our latest project, which is still under construction. If I have a plain Jane generative model, it's really a decoder of an encoder-decoder structure. This is a sequence-to-sequence map. This is the basic structure of GPT. You have an input sequence. In my case, it's the Hamiltonian parameters, so detunings, whatever, Rabi frequency, all the VIJ matrix. That's a sequence in some sense that I can push into you know, the transformer. And this is the same picture, just simplified, from that attention is all you need paper that I showed before. What the encoder does is it passes a latent vector into a decoder, and the decoder is like the thing I've been talking about. It outputs the conditional probability of, you know, qubit measurements in a sequence. So a nice thing about encoder decoders is that I can train them on pairs of Hamiltonians and, you know, quantum computing output qubit sequences. And then once it's trained, I can vary the prompt. I can ask it what happens in a different regime that I haven't trained it on. So here's our paper that we're working on, Rydberg GPT. Here is detuning, so that's big delta as a function of omega. And maybe it's hard to see, but here's an energy. And I've trained this model, or we've trained this model, on the pink points here, so there's a couple points here, a couple points in your phase transition, doesn't matter. But then what we've done is we've, after training, prompted the model with a different Hamiltonian that it hasn't seen before. So here's a different delta value right here. And the blue is the output of model one, just a model that we've trained. And we also have the exact values to compare it to. You can see it works really well. So it's an interesting example. I can train a GPT-like model, if I give it enough data, and then prompt it with different laser settings or different experimental parameters or different regions of the Hamiltonian. And I can basically get a prediction on how the quantum computer is going to behave away from the data that's already been taken. So you can imagine it as a powerful tool for quantum computing co-design. If you can basically train digital twins off of the data that's coming out of devices, and then take those digital twins, if you will, and prompt them to explain or to predict the behavior of a quantum computer in a different regime. Okay, I could keep going forever, but I'm going to stop. So back to language models. Again, they're demonstrating scaling and emergence in a very powerful way. Can we harness that, their abilities? So can we understand them? Can we use them? Quantum measurement data is perfect. So if I have a quantum computer, it's, you know, and I'm getting projective measurement outcomes, it's a perfect case to train generative models from. So I'd encourage you guys to think of quantum computers as just data generation devices. Large models, if we can train them, if we have the money to train them, will be a flexible tool to aid design and control. So I showed you how an RBM aided the design of, you know, one of these quantum computers back in 2019. Now we have much more sophisticated and powerful techniques, right? GPT type models, sequence to sequence mappers, and all these types of things. So it'll be really exciting to see how we can co-design quantum computers based on this. So for example, here's my quantum computer. That's my black box outputting my data. I have my LLM, say. I can do what I said. I can interpolate in the sense that I can use the inductive bias of my models to improve statistics, and I can improve estimators and you know, help characterize and control the device. Or I can produce out of distribution estimators by, you know, sequence to sequence mapping and things like that, so that I can predict the behavior of the quantum device away from the regime that I've measured it in, right? And so that helps in design, that can help in error correction and all things like that. So this kind of picture is, you know, is in some sense what people would maybe call co-design. So you're basically co-designing the computer and the machine learning algorithms to exist together. One produces data, you know, the other one characterizes it, controls it, and these things scale together. So that's a vision. It would be interesting to scale LLMs along with quantum computers. And I think I'll leave it at this. Can we afford to? Not just, do I have enough grant money to afford it? But can we as a species afford to be training LLMs and their carbon cost, you know what I mean, based on all of this data that's flooding out of quantum devices, you know, even 5-10 years into the future? I think it's a really interesting problem. And, you know, thanks for your attention. Thank you very much. Thanks, Mohammed.
Are there any questions?
Can you explain again, how is it possible to feed the Hamiltonian to a machine learning model?
Yeah, good question. So I didn't really cover it. So when I was talking back here, this is really the decoder. Okay, in the bottom goes the qubit measurements. Out the top comes the conditional distribution, right? So this is more of a detail of that. When I showed this, everything I showed you there is the right-hand side only. Here's the measurement outcomes. They're embedded somehow in the transformer. Here's the multi-headed attention. Here's that conditional output. But there's another structure that I didn't talk about, which is called the encoder. The encoder takes, you know, if you wanted to map French to English or something like that, this is one way of thinking of doing it. Here's French, here's English. But what it is a sequence. It's got sequence to sequence mapping. But the sequence input of this side of the transformer is the Hamiltonian. And so there's a hidden or latent vector that's passed between them. And this isn't really explaining anything technical because it's complicated and I don't fully understand it. But really, you're passing a latent representation of the Hamiltonian up into some layer of the decoder here. So you train it off of pairs of Hamiltonian and a shot. So like Hamiltonian shot, Hamiltonian shot. And every time you do that, you know, you're backpropagating the weights and biases or whatever you call it in these two devices. So that's how you enter a Hamiltonian. That's one way of thinking about it, is a sequence-to-sequence map or an encoder-decoder architecture.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm curious for this kind of task. So is there any big difference comparing models like transformers, RN, or other generative models? Are they, this performance a big difference? Because it seems they are kind of, the parameters need to learn quite few.
I don't have a good answer for that. Inference is slower in a transformer, right? It's n squared instead of n. So that's one big thing that we've noticed. So it's harder to get samples from a transformer. It takes, if your qubit scales is, you know, n, it takes n squared operations to do inference, which costs you a lot in the end. I think people believe that transformers are more expressive, maybe, because of what I talked about. You know, I talked about the attention mechanism and the pairwise correlations. So maybe there's some trade-off there. And also, transformers have demonstrated that they can scale a trillion parameters, right? So if you have a huge interacting quantum system, you might need a trillion parameters, who knows? So, but you know, I think RNNs have come back in recent months and years, showing that there maybe are RNN type strategies that could beat transformers. One is the inference cost is lower, and I don't know, you gotta ask Mohammed and Ejaz, maybe there's some other advantages to RNNs, but I think the story's not over yet. I think there's lots of work still to do on RNNs. I wouldn't be surprised if, especially in physics applications where we know a lot about correlations and entanglement and we can bake that inductive bias in, I wouldn't be surprised if RNNs still have a role to play.
Other questions? Yeah, so if you have the Hubbard model on a grid web array, for example, if you're able to implement that. So where I understand LLMs would help is basically get experimental data from a few points in the phase diagram and then use it to reconstruct the entire phase diagram. Is that correct?
Yes, that's like this picture here. I can get points on a few parts of the phase diagram and I can ask what the wave function looks like nearby. And of course, if you go too far away, it probably doesn't work, right? But if you train it more and you get close, you know, the more you train it, hopefully the better it scales and so on. So that's one you know, thing. The other thing is you may have incomplete measurements, especially in a Hubbard model where you have to have multiple basis measurements, right? So it's really expensive. You might not be able to run that experiment for, you know, years to get all that data. So if you have, you know, if you have data in a specific regime of your Hamiltonian, you can enhance it or maybe reduce the variance through modeling.
Thanks very much, Roger.
Thank you very much.